welcome to WISA Weekend, WISA's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks so much for joining us this Sunday morning. Today, we'll look at small-town police departments and the funding challenges they face. You'll meet WISA's freshman music host. 3J the DJ will join us to talk about his new show on Tuesday nights. We've got an incredible Dayton Youth Radio for you today. And later in the program, Bill Felker brings us Poor Will's Almanac. Up first, Montgomery County Alcohol, Drug Addiction, and Mental Health Services says around 75% of people become addicted to opioids through a doctor's prescription. That high number prompted a collaboration between the county, Kroger Pharmacies, and Goodwill Easter Seals to distribute free drug disposal bags. Officials say the bags are a safe, cost-effective, and environmentally responsible solution to eliminate unwanted opioid prescription drugs. In this interview with WISO, Ann Stevens with Adamus tells us about the program.
These bags are being provided by Adamus free of charge. So when you have an opiate prescription, you'll get one at a Kroger pharmacy in Montgomery County. It's cost-effective, it's safe, it's environmentally responsible. It's the way to get rid of your drugs. Of course, there are take-backs at law enforcement agencies, but you have to wait for that. This is to encourage a quick disposal so nobody else gets a hold of them. And the drop-off boxes are available in Montgomery County, typically at a law enforcement agency. You can go on the Adamus website at mcadamus.org. That's mcadamhs.org. And you can find a list of all the boxes that will take unused medications.
All right. This seems like just a really small step that could potentially have a big impact on this crisis.
We're hoping to get rid of opiates that are not being used. We want people to get them out of their medicine cabinets because they can be easily stolen by your friends, your neighbors, whoever uses your restroom. People at open houses seek medications when they're going through a house. So we don't want these drugs to get in the hands of people who aren't prescribed them.
75% of people addicted to heroin actually start out with prescription opioids before turning to that harder substance.
And we know that the opiate epidemic is in part due to prescription medications that were prescribed by pill mill doctors or doctors who are prescribing so many. You know, if you have surgery and you get Vicodin, you need it, absolutely. But when you don't need it, you still have a lot left over. And so those medications are getting into the hands of people who shouldn't have them. So we encourage safe disposal of old or new unused medications in your home every time you have a prescription.
Are there other collaborations or conversations going on with health agencies like yours and, let's say, the Miami Valley Hospital Association about all of this?
I don't believe so.
Yeah. So a number of emergencies have been declared, especially for Montgomery County. Uh-huh. Are there federal dollars coming to the area into health agencies to help with this crisis?
Montgomery County received $670,000 from the federal Cures Act to help fight the opiate epidemic. So we're using $500,000 to go toward community-based addiction and 24-hour ambulatory withdrawal management access. That means there'll be 24-hour services with Adamus continuing to fund 50% of ambulatory withdrawal management in Montgomery County. And then we are funding for community-based addiction treatment that going to build a multidisciplinary team to serve people in their homes and the community as an alternative way to get inpatient residential treatment.
And how has this opioid crisis changed how you're operating there at Adamus? Is it controlling your budgets, time, and energy?
Mm-hmm. Adamus has a total fiscal year operating budget of $31 million. About a third of our budget has been going to fight the opiate epidemic. That means we're focusing a lot of money and resources on the epidemic, as we should, but it also means that we need to cover people who are using medications that have to do with mental illness. So even though we focus on the heroin epidemic, most of our clients are those with mental health challenges.
You're not robbing Peter to pay Paul. Those budget items are set.
We're very fortunate here in Montgomery County because we have the Human Services Levy, and we're able to use those levy dollars as needed, which means there's a process that can be used to move dollars to where it's needed, such as in the opiate epidemic. And if we face a meth epidemic coming up, those dollars can also be used for that. So we're not tied in to specific dollar use with the levy. And so it's there for anything that we need, whether, you know, it's for children's services or developmentally disabled people or the heroin epidemic. We can move those dollars around where they're needed.
Ann Stevens with Montgomery County Alcohol, Drug, Addiction, and Mental Health Services. Thanks so much for your time.
Bye. Bye.
This week on Dayton Youth Radio, we have a story from Stivers School of the Arts graduate Maya Smith Custer about her best friend, her grandfather.
Let's talk about your career a little bit, Granddad.
Oh, I had a very fine career, and the president gave me a degree.
Where did you go to college?
I went to Morgan State University.
Yes, you did.
It wasn't in Washington, D.C., was it?
No, sir. Do you remember what you majored in?
That part has been difficult.
You majored in biology. Would you like to talk about that at all?
No, I don't want to talk about it, baby.
Alzheimer's is a disease. It's a progressive memory loss. There are more than 3 million cases in the U.S. a year, and it can't be cured. Isn't that crazy? My story is about my grandfather. This is my experience of taking care of someone that you love. One morning, I woke up coughing and my nose really burned. I got scared. The first thing I heard were the smoke detectors beeping. My bedroom was full of smoke. I ran into the kitchen and there was my granddad. He was wearing yesterday's sweater and smiling at me. "Good morning, young lady. Would you like some breakfast?" He wasn't even bothered by this huge cloud of smoke around him. He got upset when I threw out the burnt eggs. There was a fire truck outside so fast, I wasn't even ready for it. The firemen opened the windows and made sure the house was safe. There were about 6 of them. The first one was asking me questions like, "Are you okay? What happened? Is anyone hurt?" But what struck me was when he looked at me and asked if it was Alzheimer's. I was about to cry, and all I could do was just nod, like, "Yeah." He told me, "It's going to be a long road. Make sure you make his breakfast for him tomorrow." And they left. As soon as they were gone, I cried, and I called my mom. My mom and my 2 brothers and I moved in with my granddad a year ago. It was a major adjustment, and we had to leave the house that I grew up in to move in with him. Most people would think, well, why don't you put him in a nursing home? But he didn't really want that. And I'm glad that we were able to respect his wishes and that we are close enough that we could move in with him and that it was possible. Dementias are really hard to deal with because it definitely interferes with your daily function and it totally changes your life. It's definitely changed mine. My routine changes day to day to meet his needs first. I never imagined I'd end up being late for school to take care of him. And it's hard to explain to someone. I was late, but I couldn't leave my granddad home alone without a sandwich. I get home in the evening, and after everything I already do, bam, time flies, and I'm still trying to help granddad take his medicine, and I'm ready to go to sleep. Sometimes I'm just too tired to do my homework or too tired to study like I normally did, and I'd have to push myself to stay up late. Just the other night, he was knocking at my door, and he had a $10 bill in his hand, and he started singing me happy birthday. I told him it wasn't my birthday and that it was late and he should go back to bed. He said, oh, okay. And he went back to his room, and then as soon as the door closed, it opened back up again. And he was already in my room with the $10 bill in my hand, saying happy birthday again. I feel like my story will inspire others because everyone's going through something. You never know what their story is, and you never know what they're dealing with. I had no idea that my life would change in this way. It's hard because this is someone I love. As hard as it gets sometimes, and as much as other people don't understand, every day with him is totally worth it. For Dayton Youth Radio, at Stiver School for the Arts, this is Maya Smith-Custer.
That was a story entitled Silver and Gold, written and produced by Maya Smith-Custer from Stiver School of the Arts. Special thanks to Maya's grandpa, William Smith Sr. For Dayton Youth Radio, this is Basine Blunt.
To hear more Dayton Youth Radio stories, visit our website, wyso.org, or subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Support for Dayton Youth Radio comes from the Virginia W. Kettering Foundation and the Armand Boyer Charitable Trust, Fifth Third Bank Trustee. This is WYSO Weekend. You're listening to WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us, and very happy to have one of WYSO's latest music hosts in studio with us. It's 3J the DJ, the host of Tuesday Night's Tables of Content. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
So the new show is getting a lot of great reviews. Juliet Fromholt says it's creating Twitter storms on Tuesday night.
Awesome sauce.
You must be very pleased with the reaction.
Very much so.
All right. Well, so tell us a little bit about the philosophy behind your program.
Right now, I'm doing a chronological journey through hip-hop starting at 1979, which is the actual birthday of hip-hop. And I'm starting from there on to the golden age. Probably I'll stop at probably 1998. And then we'll just circle around the golden age of hip-hop. And then I'll start introducing other things, other aspects of hip-hop. But I found it funny that a lot of people that listen to hip-hop nowadays, they have no kind of idea of what came before. There was a before. And, you know, I just felt it, you know, important that if they understood kind of where hip-hop came from, they can have an idea like, wow, you know, why are we at this point in time in hip-hop? So,
well, tell me a little bit about yourself, if you don't mind, and then tell me how hip-hop came into your life.
Born in Dayton, 1971, and I find it kind of odd that as soon as I arrive, everything starts leaving. There was a Lakeside Park they start tearing down. I believe Lakeview Palladium was on the downside. Of course, Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin.
Right.
So, I mean, it was just a lot of things happening at the time. But, you know, in New York, there was like a lot of, you know, things happening, you know, like gang wars and all that kind of stuff. And through all of that, hip hop was born. There was, you know, several things that took place at the time, and Herc, who was a DJ, you know, he started DJing in Jamaica, and he came over here, you know, with that concept, you know, with the turntables and everything. And he brought that philosophy of the break here in like 1973. So that's like the actual, you know, time when he did his first party. It was for a sister in 1973. So actually, you know, him coming here, that's a, you know, that's gospel right there. And, you know, all of these people are still alive. So, of course, it took a while for it to get here. But about time it got here, you know, we went through our little funk phase. Then we went through the disco era. And then that's when it started, you know, it was the difference between hip hop in the street and hip hop in the club. What they call the club, the bourgeoisie, and the street DJ. And, you know, like that's where we get the meat of everything that we have nowadays. Them using the breaks and R&B records and rock and roll records as the soundtrack because they didn't have a band back then. But once we started recording hip hop, they understood that they couldn't use pre-recorded material. So they started putting bands together and they started playing these popular songs to rap over. And then thus you got the sampling laws and, hey, he used my music and, you know, all of these laws. So because of hip hop, we have like all of these new laws in music now. So
a lot of music in your family? Did your parents listen to music?
Yeah. Music was always in the house. My mom and dad brought music in. It was my mom, big James Brown fan, loved a lot of, you know, it's just countless. I can't name them all. But my father, very influential. The Spinners, the OJs, the Manhattans, Blue Magic, the Stylistics, you name it. You know, they would bring in all of that stuff. And the tail end, it was like a lot of funk stuff. You know, like funk was happening real big here. You know, of course, we got Sun, Heat Wave, Ohio Player, Zapp and Roger, Shirley Murdoch, Platypus, New Horizon. I mean, you name it. I mean, it's Slave. It's too many to name. With that, you know, I just became so infatuated with the music, and I started picking up instruments. So that was my apex, my beginning. I think most of me being involved in playing music and music in school got me into whatever was happening at the time. So I was listening to so much music, you know, so it wasn't just hip hop. It was the soul. You know, my brother was bringing in Grateful Dead and the Police and Rush and all that kind of stuff. So I became sort of like well-rounded, but my creations at the time, you know, when I started actually making beats and being in hip hop groups, you know, I was awkward because of my influence. So I started using all of this other stuff. But, you know, as hip hop grew, so did the type of genres in hip hop grew, you know, so there was, you know, rock influence, jazz influence, you know, definitely funk. And, you know, that's, you know, how it all began.
So the name of your show is Tables of Content.
Yes.
And we've seen you demonstrate turntables.
Yeah.
Referring to. So you actually do some scratching. Have you done that in your show yet?
No, not yet. But I will pretty soon after I get finished with the my hip hop lesson. I call this my hip hop lesson.
Yeah.
I don't know of anybody that ever had did a journey from beginning to golden age hip hop. And, you know, just to take each year, you know, starting, you know, at the beginning of hip hop and play every important record. So I figure if I do that, I'm giving an accurate picture of what, you know, like how hip hop grew. And through that, I hope my listening audience can actually see the influence from these architects and, you know, like see where some of these new cats are taking their style from.
Oh, that's great. So if you've missed the first couple of programs, your playlists are online?
Yeah, well, I'm in the process of getting ready to put them online. And what I'm going to do at the request of actually a listener that came in and through our Queen Bee, Nikki Dakota, I'm going to start putting it in so when people listen, they can actually see what it is and where to buy it, so on and so forth.
Awesome. A great hit on Tuesday nights from 8 to 10, Tables of Content.
That's right. Don't meet me there. Beat me there.
3J the DJ, thanks
Indeed.
For your time.
Thank you for having me.
And again, you can check out the program Tuesday nights at 8 o'clock on WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us this morning. In Ohio, more than three-quarters of law enforcement agencies employ 20 officers or less. Residents say they want quick response times to crimes, but the funding to pay personnel doesn't always match expectations. It's an issue for smaller police stations here in Southwest Ohio and across the state. Up next on WYSO Weekend, we'll hear about one police station in the small town of Kirkersville, about 45 minutes east of Columbus, from member station WOSU in Columbus. Debbie Holmes reports.
Licking County has 686 square miles and 14 police departments, and of course there's the Licking County Sheriff's Office. The small village of Utica, with a population of less than 2,200, has its own police department, three full-time and 13 part-time officers. Police Chief Clifford Bigler started working here more than 20 years ago. Bigler says his $317,000 budget only goes so far.
We've learned to adapt and to do our jobs, and I think we do a real good job at doing our job with what we have.
Last year, the department updated its dispatching center, so now calls go through the centralized 911 center in Newark. Six part-time dispatchers in Utica lost their jobs. Bigler admits the officers use older equipment like the radar and some patrol cars. Two used cars came from the Ohio State Patrol. Bigler says the Licking County Sheriff's Office assists when needed.
We have the luxury of, you know, having a sheriff's office that is very well equipped, has a lot of resources that they can offer to us. But we are far enough north that if we were not here, I think that would cause a hindrance on them because that would be extra territory that they would have to cover.
After 40 years in law enforcement, Port Clinton police officer Mike Kilburn knows the financial strains of small police departments. He served as police chief in Kirkersville for 1 year during the 1990s. His department included about a dozen volunteer officers.
You quickly learn that the very first problem that you have is that there is a financial vacuum where there's not the money to necessarily properly equip officers, to give them the training that I've seen in larger departments. And so all that becomes very scary.
Training varies widely between agencies. All officers must meet a state minimum standard, but small agencies may not need and can't afford extra training. Jay McDonald heads the Ohio Fraternal Order of Police.
If you're in a small town, you might not necessarily need the same kinds of advanced training that you would need if you're assigned to a specialized task force in a large metropolitan area. So we shouldn't mandate the same kinds of training and those kinds of things for these kinds of agencies.
Small agencies do have backup. Licking County Sheriff's deputies regularly patrol communities like Kirkersville and Utica. Captain Darrow Evans.
Yeah, there's lapses when they're not out, and I can't tell you exactly what hours they work. And a lot of times we'll hear them out early morning. It's hit and miss when they're out. But it doesn't really create much of a burden on us. Our guys just pick up the calls like we would any other call.
That raises the question, with sheriff's departments and low crime rates, do these communities need their own police departments? Former Kirkersville Police Chief Mike Kilburn.
When you start talking about Alexandria and you start talking about Kirkersville, you're talking about 600 people, 500 people, 400 people. And is that enough to support a police department? It's not.
Many times, small departments rely on traffic fines to pay the bills. Greg Lawson with the Buckeye Institute says the organization supports adequate funding for law enforcement, but some communities should consider merging their police departments.
We do need to ask the question of how many might need their own unique force versus what can we still do that still it maintains public safety, but still does it at a way that is cost effective.
But the FOP's Jay McDonald says for places like Kirkersville, a police department is an important part of the community.
The people who are policing in these really small towns are doing it because they want to protect people and they want to do the right things, because why else would you get into something where you could give your life for something that pays you no money? Nobody's getting rich in Kirkersville.
For Ohio Public Radio, I'm Debbie Holmes.
You can find more stories from Ohio Public Radio stations on our website at wyso.org.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the first week of middle summer, the second week of the sweet corn moon, the week of Aphelion, and the first week of the second half of the year. I walked down toward the river in the morning. All around me, leaves were turning a deeper green from the advance of the season. Toward the water, white hobblebush hydrangeas in bloom brightened the undergrowth. Cobwebs of Microthena spiders lay across my way. I found a cluster of webworms on a buckeye tree. Two iridescent tiger beetles raced in front of me. I saw that some honeysuckles had orange berries. Solomon's plume had brown berries. Blackberries were green. Raspberry branches with sweet black fruit hid behind the touch-me-nots. Catchweed seeds were yellowing and they stuck to my shoes. I picked and sampled a bitter mayapple. Near the wetlands, moss on a fallen tree glowed in the canopy twilight. Spent watercress lay upended in a shallow backwater. A few shining blue damselflies hovered near the aging skunk cabbage. I listened to cardinals, a thrush and a pileated woodpecker. All around me, robins clucked and peeped to guide their young. These things and more came into me, and for the duration of that walk, seemed to change my life in a cascade of alterations that left nothing the way it was at the beginning. Each act of awareness transforming the way I saw the world, and then those transformations compounding and coloring the awareness of observations to come, making the whole world new. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the second week of middle summer. In the meantime, walk in the woods, changing yourself.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at wyso.org.
That's it for this edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. I'm Jerry Kenny. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 10. Coming up next on WISO, it's Vic McCunis with The Book Nook.